Can I take you first to paragraph 43 here at once, please? There you say that the area limits in Rule 311.4.8 are not an appropriate use of the NEWA model information because they are based on fixed numerical limits from overseer applied at the sub-catchment scale. Is that your understanding of the government advice on the use of overseer, or should I ask Mr. Ford that question? Right. But it's not using an overseer limit in a regulation, rather it's using a report that used overseer to set an area. And then using that area in regulation, isn't it?
Yes, I'm trying to go to those areas, and they're directly based on overseer numbers.
So you don't think that overseer can be used in that way to estimate an area and then use that area in regulation?
No, I don't think so. What?
If we can go down to paragraph 54. Sorry, 55 and 56. So my understanding of what you've done here is you're setting out the implications of removing the area limits in Rule 311.4.8, Table 1, by summarising the potential end-noting impacts of CVP expansion at the FMU and sub-catchment scale in these paragraphs. And I think you've answered other questions. The limited proportional change that you've estimated. Now, then if we go down to I'm sorry, I can't find a particular part in your evidence, but you agree with Ms. Holmes that those increases could be readily compensated for by decreases, for example, in E. coli? And I'm sorry, I can't quite
find
it. Yes, that's it. So, are you solely relying on Ms. Holmes' evidence for that, or is that your opinion as well?
That's my opinion as well, and that's based on some of the information I've looked at and the work that I've done with Block 3, which appears in this bank exhibit in the channel of the study room last week, which is a reduction of E. coli.
Expansion, So that gets us into the issue of trading one contaminant for another in terms of the offset, whether you wish to call it offset or compensation methodology. Have you read the evidence of Dr. Corkery?
No, I haven't.
All right. So what framework would you propose to use for that trading? Previously there was reference to Table 311.2, which had a prioritisation of contaminants of each subcatchment, and then that table used to set out which subcatchments had a problem for the particular nutrient N.
That's right. So I used that table to remove the N priority subcatchments from the expansion analysis that I did.
Alright, so are you aware that that table is now being proposed to be deleted?
Yeah, I'm aware that it's in process.
So how would you now go about ascertaining what subcatchments had a problem with N?
Well, I'm just starting to get into some questions about that kind of stuff with the catchment campaign information. I think it's just been providing.
So, please, Steve.
Thank you.
And so, you participated in the Joint Witness Conferencing of Freshwater.
Yes.
Where you agreed with various statements, including that nutrient sensitive downstream receiving environments include lakes, wetlands, and the Waikato estuary. Questions 5 and 6. And
not the working issues. I think they agreed that there was some management data. But like some of the agreed that that's a sensitive judgment on grounds.
Alright, and at question 16 the question was, are the total nitrogen and total phosphorus target attribute states for the main stem of the Waikato River adequate to achieve ecosystem health? And you agree that there's a relatively high degree of uncertainty in the determination of those long-term thresholds, etc. In that note.
Yes.
And at question 7, that the nitrate, nitrogen, and ammonia nitrogen target states and tributaries whether they are adequate to achieve ecosystem health, that they only address toxicity effects, not other components of ecosystem health.
Yes.
And if I can take you to question 28. We understand that the NPCG and Institute of Fire do not allow for further increases of contaminants at catchment scale, the level of contaminants are fully or over allocated. Increases in contaminants will increase the risk that targets will not be achieved.
On the allocated generic is in relation to the target attribute statement, isn't it?
Well, the definition of the NPCP is slightly broader than that, and it refers to degrading or degrading the upper body.
Okay.
And you have agreed with that. So these issues will, as you are understanding, be addressed in the 2024 plan change that the Regional Council intends to promulgate. Could you just answer for the reason? And so The CCCV is not going to be able to provide adequate information, is it, on which catchments are probably going to be problematic for nitrogen? Because we need to address all these information requirements. Well, do you have a view on that or not? Because there's a lot, what I'm putting to you is that there's a lot of work to be done for the 2024 plan change, and you seem to be aware of all that work, yet be proposing that increases in nitrogen could be compensated for by decreases in E. coli. But we would need to know, wouldn't we, the subcatchments where nitrogen is a particular problem at the very least for that sort of approach?
I don't think necessarily that that would help in the assessment that I did was in relation to the table and the priority elements.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Ferguson, any questions tomorrow? New re-examination.
Stay the same in terms of total nitrogen load from the existing and increased area, you need to achieve a 30% reduction in current loads. Is that correct or not?
Current loads from CDP?
Yes.
Yeah, correct. Yeah, around 30%.
Yeah. Okay. 30%. Are you able to comment on how practical you think that might be, knowing the existing circumstances of CDP growers in the Waikato area?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a question for Stuart Ford. I have his evidence, he does refer to some of the anchoring modelling and that was discussed briefly before. I think it was about 24% reduction that could be achieved with more improved irrigation scheduling. I don't know how helpful that is to all CDP.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Risen.
The solemnly sincerely and truthfully declaring and affirm this evidence we are about to give to the school shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
Could you please state the full name for the court? And have you prepared?
Sorry,
as well. Have you prepared written evidence and participated in and reported on joint witness conferencing on water quality in this appeal?
Okay.
And in all of that, have you agreed to and have complied with the code of conduct for expert witnesses?
Okay.
And is the evidence that you've given true and correct to the best of your knowledge?
It is.
Thank you. Well, I could just ask you to stay seated to answer any questions that anyone might have.
Thank you. Mr. Coleman.
Thank you, sir. Good afternoon, Sam. Do
Do you agree with the view Dr. Scarborough expressed under cross-examination that if you replaced dairy farms with CDP, all else being equal, what you would see is a likely reduction in E. coli, but a likely increase in nitrogen and monitoring stations nearby, and possibly an increase in sediment?
That's
the
farm
scale?
Yes.
Thank you. Now, have you got a copy of Dr. Sarsbrook's rebuttal evidence there?
I don't, sorry.
Behind you, there should be a volume 301. Oh, that's a good question. It's page 301-0140. I feel like that'll probably be volume part one.
So it was
301-0114 is the document, yes. If you could turn to his paragraph 93, which is on page 301-0140. I just want to talk to you about CDP expansion first. So you'll see there he says, to the extent there are planning reasons to support the expansion of CDP, they're addressed to Mr. Fukuoka's evidence. Dr. Strasbrook says, I consider this expansion should not occur in certain sensitive sub-catchments, and he goes on to explain how he would define those, for example, lake catchments from Marina Wetland, and those sub-catchments that already breached or are close to breaching national bottom lines. And then he goes on to, well actually at that point, would you agree with what he said there?
Yes, I do agree, and actually most of those extensions are all on the Eastern in London anyway.
Yes, and so there's a list of eight particular sub-catchments that he's listed there that indicate where those are, and one of them is, I think Mr. Reston talked about the Fokker Dam, and that's the listed there. And to illustrate that, have you got a copy of the provisions, the council's post-conferencing provisions there?
Yes,
right. Could you please turn to page 58 of those provisions? And what you should have when you get there is table 311.1b, dissolved nitrogen and phosphorus attribute states.
Yes.
And so you've got stepping through a range of sub-catchments. If you skip through to page 60, you will see Fokker sub-catchment being the third one listed there. Have you got that?
Yes, I've got that.
And so, just for example, when we look at medium nitrate, the current state is listed here as 3.5 milligrams per litre, which, casting my eye up and down that column, is much higher than any of those other ones. So that really reinforces the point that that's a sensitive subject.
Yes, yes, yes.
And then, you'll recall, and it's consistent with what you've just said, but just to clarify, the water quality JWS in question 45 agreed if CDP land uses were allowed to expand, resulting in increased nitrogen or other contaminant losses, the encatchments with sensitive water bodies, e.g. lakes, wetland aquifers, should be avoided. So that's something you agree to at that point, and you still hold that view.
Yes, I still hold that view. And once again, that was also.
Yes, and so that's fairly clear. Now, I wonder if you could turn to paragraph 26 of your evidence. And there you talk about rotation at the FMU scale, and you've talked in the context there of an estimated 97 hectares of CDP that has been rezoned urban in the region. And you've explained there your view, perhaps referred to Mr. Reston's view, that rotation at the FMU scale would provide for all of those 97 hectares to rotate onto new land.
Yes.
Do you agree that from a water quality perspective, it would be helpful to assess the sensitivity of the land that that CVP moves on to performing before confirming the relocation of the CVP?
Well, that's part of the environment plan, which you would then look at.
Yes, and so if that was moving on to some other land, you'd have to look at the sensitivity of that land.
Yes, it's all incorporated as part of
the land. Yes. And in the context of the sensitive subcatchments we've just been talking about, if there was a subcatchment with a sensitive water body in it, say the property people, if a CVP operator wanted to rotate all or part of that 97 hectares of CVP into the Whakapipi subcatchment, it would be important to carefully assess that to understand whether that was appropriate, wouldn't it?
Yes, it's also my understanding it's probably limited available land in Whakapipi for anything new to go into it, but yes, you can assess it based on sensitivity.
Yes, and the same would go for any of those other sensitive subcatchments. And so there may be situations where expansion into those subcatchments would be inappropriate.
Yeah, that's probably, yeah, and also, yeah, it's on the eastern log of those sensitive catchments, which was the Scars Rock, would be also used, excluded any catchments in any of the priority contaminant and tables really into.
And so, even though at the moment we're talking about rotation, in the words used in your evidence, rotation of 97 hectares of CVP, for that new subcatchment, if it was to move, despite your advice, that CVP was to be relocated, rotated into a new subcatchment that was one of the sensitive ones. From that sensitive subcatchment's perspective, that's an expansion, isn't it?
I think from a water quality perspective, it's still a rotation. It's like there is a component of the risk assessment tool for CVP that looks at your risk, and for it to allow it to rotate, you have to assess the risk of it. Your new location and your risk has to be the same. That's how it works.
So you assess the risk. If there were higher risks, well then you would have to manage them or not rotate
in
yes.
Location.
So it may be inappropriate to rotate into some locations in that situation.
It would depend on the site specifics, but yes, it could. There may be situations where the
assessment tool
shows that there's a higher risk.
And with, if I can call it, standard crop rotation that's not driven by urban expansion, there's an ability for the crop to rotate to a new, or the CVP to rotate to a new piece of land and then rotate back.
Correct.
But where the land that it's rotating from is now taken up by houses, you can't rotate back.
You can't rotate back, correct.
And so it would be important to understand the level of permanence, perhaps, of the rotation into any new subcatchment.
Yes.
Thank you, Ms. Holmes. Thank you, Rob.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you, sir. Just a couple.
Good afternoon, Mr. Holmes. I've just got a couple of clarifying questions from the evidence. So if you could turn to paragraphs 57 and 58 of the evidence. And so there in 57, you acknowledge referring to the panel's decision around not allowing the gains to the health and well-being of Waikato and Waipa rivers from the actions of one sector to offset the losses of another sector. But then you go on to say, therefore, I agree with the commissioners that offsetting and compensation should be undertaken in narrow, carefully controlled circumstances. Can you explain what you mean by narrow, carefully controlled circumstances in terms of compensation?
Well, it's really around the issue that needs to be done under the discretionary activity for extension. So it's you've got to do the assessment. You've got to see whether, for a start, under policy 5, you see whether if there was going to be an increase in white tracks, you see whether that's the contaminant of concern. And then, if it is, it's unlikely that CBD extension will occur. If it's not, well, then you need to do the assessment as to you still need to look at it from a farm scale with the EPP and risk assessment. You then need to look at the subcatchment, like some of the effects of that, and then you need to step right up to the river level and do that assessment to make sure that everything is, you know, your effects are just a minor. And then it's at the discretion of council. So that it is quite controlled in terms of the assessment that you need to do before you can get that expansion.
So where does the effects management hierarchy fit in to your assessment? So the avoid, remedy, mitigate before you
leave. That's really the farm environment plan. But so that is your property scale assessment of exactly what's happening on site, what you're doing to mitigate. Across all four contaminants, that's the farm scale effect, and then you need to look up to see what when you've got that sorted out, and you go up to the subcatchment scale, what the effects of that, and then go up to the river scale and do that.
Okay, so if there are residual effects in offsetting and compensation is required, what type of guidance do you see would be appropriate for that offsetting or compensation?
Well, in terms of, if it has to be like fully offsetted, it's unlikely. I mean, Mr. Ford has covered this in his evidence from an economic point of view. It's unlikely that CDB expansion will happen. It's around looking at the effects of the overall improvement of the health of the entire river. And so there may be some catchments where E. coli, I mean, there are a lot of catchments, I think, the latest SME monitoring. I know it's the entire Waikato region, it's like 67% of catchments are DME for E. coli. And it's kind of acknowledged that there needs to be big improvements. There's a lot of improvements to done for E. coli. So it's looking at those specific elements of the catchment and looking at the nitrate overall across catchments.
And just focusing in on offsetting and compensation, have you read the evidence of Dr. Corkery, the Attorney General? And so you'd be familiar then in her evidence around the her recommendation based on her expertise is that the principles in the NPSFM and the Appendix 6 and Appendix 7, aquatic offsetting and compensation principles, she recommends that those be followed or considered in any offsetting and compensation. Have you factored that into assessment?
I've really looked at how policy 5 would be implemented in terms of prioritisation of contaminants and how that is linked to the tables really into.
So in your statement here about the ability for aquatic offsetting and compensation, in your evidence at 57, you're not factoring in the guidelines for offset of compensation, you're not factoring in the Appendix 6 or 7 from the... Is that because you don't consider those irrelevant, or what's the
idea there? No, it was really because I was focusing on the prioritisation of the contaminants and how that was going. And with the assumption that if there were catchments that had nitrogen as the most concern, then it was unlikely that the compensation would happen. So there wouldn't be any offsetting compensation.
Right, that's good. And so just moving then to paragraph 58, you're referring to Table 3, Level 2, that's that priority table.
I guess just to clarify, in terms of the joint witness statement, and as my friend Ms. Fongley mentioned, there's a proposal for that table to be removed. Can you support that?
I supported Table 3.11.2 in my evidence because it provided really clear guidance to if an applicant wanted to expand, it's quite clear in the plan which catchments were from a CDP perspective, which ones had nitrogen as a priority catchment, and where it was unlikely you could expand. So I supported it in terms of a clarity point of view. During the conferencing, it became clear how the table was devised in terms of, to my understanding, that it was done based on hotspots of nitrogen and not looking at sort of downstream system environments and things like that. So, and also it was based on data from the baseline, which was 2010-2014, recognising that things have changed since then. So I support the new method that we have. Which number it is in the plan, which outline the sub-catchment, or have the, and identify the contaminants of most concern. Because that would be based on the most up-to-date data at the time, so you're getting more up-to-date data on the basis of your assessment on. But I do acknowledge that, I mean, we haven't seen what it looks like at the moment, so it was acknowledged in the joint witness statement that although it sounded like that was a good method, none of us have seen what one of those reports would actually look like, so
right.
It's hard to assess what.
So is there evidence that you need to see that before you will do you still support the removal of Table 3.11.2 regardless?
I support having most of that data as a basis of assessment on. So
that's not Table
3.11.2. Yeah, that's not, and I acknowledge it's not Table 3.11.2.
Okay.
So,
thank you.
Thank you,
Sue.
Good afternoon, Ms. Holmes. Just a couple of questions. And so if we go to your evidence, I guess particularly interested in your paragraphs 13 to 15. You got those there?
Okay.
And so 13 goes through the figures that we've seen, we've heard a number of times. 14 then goes and looks at E. coli on a sub-catchment basis.
Yes.
And then 15 looks at sediment on a sub-catchment basis.
Can I just interrupt? There is, under 14, although I would say it's less than 3.5%, which is still correct, as Stan has talked about previously, there was an error in those. But, so that number's coming from there, is actually 0.1%.
Sure. So 14 and 15, in terms of E. coli and sediment, you look at that at a sub-catchment basis. You don't do a similar sub-catchment basis analysis for nitrogen or phosphorus, though, do you?
No, not in this.
Because if you did look at, or have you undertaken that analysis? From your understanding, though, there are sub-catchments where CBP is the dominant contributor of nitrogen.
My understanding is one of the sub.
And so the contribution that CBP could make at a sub-catchment level could be, it's far greater than the 2.5% that's referred to in your paragraph 13.
Yeah, essentially
it doesn't
be the one catchment where it's the dominant.
But even if it weren't the most significant, it will still be a significant contributor in a number of catchments, won't it? Sub-catchments.
I've done that.
Okay, thank you. No further questions.
Thank you. Mr. Thompson. Thank you. Mr. Rowe.
take you to paragraph 48 of your evidence.
Sorry, what paragraph?
48. In paragraph 48, you state that your colleagues and yourself previously completed a review on the three core values within PC1, human health for recreation, ecosystem health and climate health, and identified the impact that relevant water quality attributes would have on these values, and then you provide a summary. And at 49, while the review indicates all four contaminants are important, some, such as E. coli, can be used as a direct measure for multiple core values. And at 50, you further discuss E. coli and state that nitrogen is a direct measure of only one core value. Therefore, the focus on nitrogen originally proposed in PC1 is unlikely to achieve fulfillment of the four values. If we refer to the MPSCCM compulsory values, they include, well, I think you acknowledge ecosystem health.
Yes.
And ecosystem health has five physical components, and one of those is water quality, which includes the physical and chemical measures of the water. And nutrients. And so are you suggesting that human contact and homokai are more important than ecosystem health?
Mm-hmm. No, not at all. It was more around this was done in the very early stages. There was a lot of discussion just around nitrates, and it was really that was nitrates related to ecosystem health. And so it was really just providing, so E. coli is, fixing E. coli can, or making improvements to E. coli can contribute to the core values of the plan, was really the point.
It's just from one, but it's indeed just one. Yeah. And this is not the case, though, that all these core values, which I think you've aligned with the MPSCCM compulsory values, need to be managed. All of them need to be managed.
Yep.
All right. Thank you. And I have a question to Ms. Toomai, who talked about Table 311.2 and how that had been deleted, and how we now rely on the information to be provided in the consenting process through the catchment context challenges and values method.
Yes.
And you're aware that there is further work that needs to be done in order to understand the importance of nitrogen at various sub-catchments in order to inform the CCCV?
Yeah, there's some sub-catchments, but there is data available for others.
Right. And so, are you familiar with Dr. Scarsbrook's rebuttal evidence where he talks about the significant advances that have been made over the last 2 to 3 years relating to relationships between nutrient concentrations and ecosystem health outcomes, including the care of nitrogen and macroinvertebrates, with respect to clause 3.13 of the MPSCCM? So could it be the case then, because the other issue is, isn't it, that the attribute states have not been back calculated to the tributaries. Each tributary is treated as an isolated piece. Yeah. So isn't it the case that these resource consent applications could come forward for various sub-catchments and there won't be this information available?
This is what I was saying, that there was uncertainty, and we did put that in the joint witness statement, that it sounded like this was a good idea of what it's going to be, but we haven't cited it, so we don't know. So, I can't comment any more on that, because I haven't seen what it looks like, which is kind of why I was called a table 311.2,
Thank you very much.
In paragraph 10 of your executive summary, you say, in addition, I believe the calculated increase in nitrogen load as a result of 1877 hectare expansion of CVP will have negligible effect on all the quality, which is what you're saying there.
Yes.
And I understand you're saying that you were saying that partly because of the things to be evaluated against policies 3 and 5, is that right?
Yes.
But are you saying that some increase in load may still be possible as a result of that?
Well, I think there's also a discussion around the fact that this was the conservative model, its worst case, and it didn't take into consideration the improvement that PC1 will drive. So there is. So although it's put down as 0.5% total increase, it actually will be, there's still going to be improvement within the catchment, it will just be less improvement than what would occur without this extension.
So, really, you're, in part, you're relying on other people to improve things.
So, the CDP will improve as well.
Sorry?
The CDP needs to improve as well.
Okay. But coming back to my question, are you saying that there will be some increase, or there could be some increase, as a result of the CVP expansion?
Okay. Yes.
Okay. Well, on what basis, what evaluation, what analysis, what methodology did you use to conclude that the effects would be negligible? Because we seem to be in a situation where we don't even know whether it's nitrogen or phosphorus sensitive. There are some fairly challenging scientific issues when you get down to this level.
Yeah, it was really around this increase is based before any mitigations are going to be in place. So there will be improvements in the subcatchment. It's just less of an improvement than what would happen if that expansion did not occur.
Okay, I didn't understand the few reference. No, I didn't think so.
Anything arising? Oh, just one question. Oh, thank you.
When you're saying that there could be that increase, what at what level do you think that could occur?
Like at plant scale. And so it's before it hits the river. And so at an FMU scale, that's where you're looking at the level.
Thank you. That's all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Produce all the GAP documents with us, and I prefer to do that first thing in the morning. So I was going to propose Mr. Ford, and you can whip through him in the time available. So on that basis, I call Stuart Ford.
Shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
Could you please take a full name for the court?
Stuart John Ford.
And have you prepared a statement of evidence and rebuttal evidence and participated in and signed on to joint witness reporting in this appeal?
Yes, I have.
Undertaking all that work, have you complied with the code of conduct for expert witnesses?
Yes, I have.
And did you have any corrections to make to any of your evidence?
Yes, I have. In the joint witness statement, for economics and modelling. Question 7, matters of disagreement. I'm sorry, it's not pages aren't numbered.
In fact, involves the Director General proposal on commercial vegetable production.
Yes. And the matters of disagreement, it's got SF and KC disagree. My name shouldn't be there. So could you please cross it out? And so it'll just be KC disagreements.
Anything else?
No, that's not.
Very good.
So do you, other than that, confirm that your evidence is true and correct to the best of your knowledge and belief?
Yes, sir.
Thank you. In that case, you just stay seated for any questions anyone might have.
So,
I'll just start at paragraph 77 of your evidence in chief.
Yes.
And you say that if growers were provided the flexibility to rotate at FMU scale, it would support the economic performance of businesses by managing the risk of pests and disease. And it goes on, but that's the relevant part. Now, next I want to go to the evidence of Stu Easton, Mr. Easton, which is in folder, the green folder, dark green. It's got 314 at the top. That's the one. And we're under tab 3, which is page 315.0036. And if you could go to figure 1, which is page 0047.
So what was the page number again?
315.0047. He's got three diagrams of three different growers, and it shows how they've changed the blocks that they've farmed over the years 2016 to 2019. And just to get a sense of the scale that we're talking about, at least with these three examples, grower one, if you go extremity to extremity, it would be about 2 to 3 kilometres. Does that sound about right to you? Just carry that off.
Yes, one is two, one is two.
Thank you. And grower two, that's a bigger scale. If you scale that off, it looks like approximately 8 or so kilometres from extremity to extremity. Does that sound about right to you?
Yes, that's right.
And then grower three, again, extremity to extremity, it would be about 17 kilometres. Does that sound about right?
Yes.
want to go to now to proposed comments and version of provisions, and there's a copy on the table in front of you there to your right. Go to page 8, which is the map of the SMUs.
Yes.
And if we take the lower Waikato River FMU as an example, which is the northernmost FMU there, by flexibly to rotate within that, within an FMU, you are proposing that each consent holder could take their maximum area of CVP in the baseline period and put it anywhere within that FMU? Is that what you're suggesting?
I'm not suggesting, yeah. I'm saying that if growers are provided the flexibility to rotate at the FMU scale, it would support the economic performance of businesses by managing the risk of pests and diseases.
Yeah, I'm just trying to get down to what you mean by flexibility to rotate at the FMU scale. Does that mean anywhere, putting the maximum anywhere within it? So it's about 100 kilometres, would you estimate, from the top of the FMU to the bottom, if you scale that off?
Yes.
And that's a much bigger area than the three examples that Mr. Easton gave. Would you agree with that?
Yes, it is.
Just to be clear, Mr. Fisher, I realise that my interchange with council was on submissions rather than evidence. My understanding from council's submissions is that that's not the proposal of Horticulture New Zealand. My understanding is that they'd like to be able to move things around, but it would still be subject to what was identified in the relevant FEP. And this isn't a case of just being able to pick up their crop or their seed and go anywhere they like. It's just a question of where they might rotate within an area identified in the farm environment.
Yeah, so it becomes a question then, doesn't it, of what they identify in their farm environment planning?
Absolutely. Isn't that what Plan Change 1's all about for everybody? What is in the farm environment plan?
Yes.
And what is approved under the farm environment plan?
Yes.
Is there a requirement that, in terms of KGC, that they operate in accordance with the farm environment plan?
Yes, but it's a question of where in the... Where within the FMU the land is that they actually identify within the farm environment plan.
But your question seemed to me to be premised on the notion that they could just operate wherever they liked. And what I'm putting to you is that my understanding of the relief which is sought by Horticulture New Zealand is that they'd like to be able to identify within an FEP areas wider than, say, within a single subcategory. They are putting a limit on that of an FMU. Now, obviously, if you compare map 311 to map 311.2, the relative scale of subcatchments and FMUs is enormous. But I just think we need to be careful. If what you're putting to this witness is, and he's answering, I think, accurately, yes, that would be possible, but I think that for our benefit, we need to be aware that there would still be a limit.
Yes, there would be a maximum area.
No. Mr. Fisher. The farmer would have to stay where it was they were going to farm.
Yes.
And that wouldn't be... I mean, in fact, that would effectively probably have to come down to parcels of land. Whether you look at that in terms of figure 1 in Mr. Easton's evidence, and whether it's 2 kilometres or 17 kilometres, and I don't know, because growers, it might be 50 kilometres. But if what you're putting to the witnesses, they can go wherever they like, I'm just saying I'm not sure that that is a foundation for that question. They can go wherever they've nominated, they intend to go, and it's been approved by the council.
Yes, that would be a more accurate way of putting it.
I think you need to come back to that, because it just seems to me that to advance a line of questioning on the idea that there'd be no control over that, which is what I heard and what I heard your friend say to the previous witness, I just think is headed off on a tangent that's not within the scope of the evidence in front of us.
Okay, thank you, Sue. I'll take that on board.
I mean, I'd add this before we go too much further, but in terms of what may be raised with witnesses for the commercial vegetable production industry, does the council oppose rotation?
No, it doesn't, Sue.
Right, well then what we need is a framework within which rotation can operate on a planned and enforceable basis, don't we?
Yes.
Right, thank you.
So just acknowledging the point made by the judge that any location that is identified and proposed will be controlled through the farm environment plan process to an extent. So acknowledging that, but are there economic benefits for a grower in having farm properties clustered together?
Yes, there are in terms of the economies of running businesses which are closely located.
Right, and what would they be sharing?
But there may be the opposite to that, the mix of land of having a further apart may be more appropriate for what they want to grow.
Right, and starting with the benefits of proximity, what would they be?
Oh, that comes out just ease and low cost of transport between properties, basically.
Yep. So just sharing equipment, transport costs of produce.
Yes.
To a packing house, for example.
Well, I mean, a packing house may not be on your property, so, you know, it may or may not be an advantage.
Right.
So in terms of the location.
Right. And managerial oversight, could that be another benefit?
It may or may not be really. I know that some of the larger operations have a great spread of operations throughout the country and still provide adequate managerial oversight to that.
Okay. In terms of those benefits that you have identified there, it would be in the grower's interest to maximise those benefits, wouldn't it?
As long as those benefits outweigh the other benefits of having them further apart. And they may or may not, according to an individual operation.
Right. And could that lead to concentration of some, of at least some concentration of farm blocks?
It may do.
And that can have localised effects on water quality, which could in turn affect achieving of such sub-catchment targets. Do you agree with that?
Sorry, sir. Frame the question again.
That concentration can have localised effects on water quality.
That may do.
And that in turn could affect the achievement of some such sub-catchment targets. Would you agree with that?
No.
paragraph 76 of your evidence. You say there that the overall footprint of cultivated land is relatively static.
That's based on this estimate.
Yes, okay. And then paragraph 77, you go on to say that farmers are most likely swapping land with each other.
The end of 76.
Yeah, the end of 77. Or is it both perhaps? So a similar point been made in both paragraphs. So what are the formal arrangements that happen when this land swapping occurs between growers?
I'm not highly cognizant with what the formal arrangements are, but I'm aware that they can be formal lease agreements through to an agreement to swap land.
Right. And where consents are applied, for example, if there's a water tank for irrigation, something like that, how does that work? And who? What I mean by that is who holds the consent and what arrangements are in place to allow the use of the consent?
Sorry, that's outside my expertise.
Under PC1, all existing CVP requires a consent, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
Now, if we go to Rule 3.11.4.5 in that post-conferencing version of the provisions, that's page 29 of those post-conferencing provisions.
Okay.
And this question actually relates in part, I think, to one of the questions that I was raising. So condition one there, under that rule, it requires the property and properties used for crop rotation, as it's been amended, to be registered. That's right.
Yes.
And then if we go down to condition four, that requires that FEP to cover existing areas and, as far as practicable, anticipate as areas of crop rotation. That's right, isn't it?
Yes.
So the existing areas of CVP will be identified through the application process. That's right, isn't it?
Yes, that's true.
And the way this is drafted, in some cases it won't be practical to identify anticipated areas. That's your reading also?
Yes, that's true.
Are you able to talk us through about the difficulties in identifying anticipated areas in advance?
I guess they would be that a grower wouldn't be certain what areas that they may carry out their operation on in the future. They may have an idea of land that they're likely to use it on, that they'd like to expand, or also not expand, that's the term, to change their operation to.
Okay, so and these provisions are drafted in a way to allow some flexibility to accommodate that, that practical aspect. two conditions, three now, conditions two and three, which really go hand in hand. What they do together is they set the maximum area within each sub-catchment for which consent is sought. So each consent has a maximum area per sub-catchment. Is that your reading of it? And growers could shift onto different land within those sub-catchments, provided they stay within their consented maximum. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. Now, this next question relates to the point raised by Azona, but condition three doesn't specifically say anything to restrict rotation across different parcels of land, does it? Whether between sub-catchments or within FMUs?
Well, it refers to sub-catchment, it doesn't say anything about FMUs.
No, but it doesn't say anything about restricting rotation either, does it?
No, it doesn't.
Now, could a grower who wishes to exceed their sub-catchment maximum, do you think they could rely on consent of another grower as long as the maximum that other growers consent is complied with?
Fundamentally, that would be correct, I would think.
Okay, thank you. No further questions.
I just have one quick question, so I can't take too long.
Good afternoon, Mr. Head.
Good afternoon.
So I'm on this turmoil, I'm the boy of the dock, and so I just had one question with regards to your rebuttal evidence. Do you have a copy there?
Yes, I have.
And just in regards to paragraph 9, you've raised a concern, understandably, regarding there being no evidence around dairy and sheep and, well, sorry, that the evidence that the Director General's economist provided was on dairy, beef and sheep and not on CBP.
That's correct.
So I've just got a register, just got a document to put to Mr. Ford, please. Copies for the court. And if you could turn to page 6 of that document, please. And then down the bottom in the maintenance section of that page, it talks about the regular inspection of buffer strips, especially during after rainfall, the necessary pulling, if necessary pulling of any channelisation of pathways, near the level of the headband in front of the vegetation. So it's all around the maintenance, but
yes.
What I'm particularly interested in is on the right-hand side, it's got some annual costs there. Annual costs include the value of land occupied by the buffers of $50 to $130 per hectare of productive land, plus maintenance, $10 to $40 per productive hectare, and then in the first year costs, installation and leave range between $175 and $310 per productive hectare, and then year two onwards, maintenance and lease cost ranges between 70 and 160 per productive hectare. So it's my only question to you on that is, might that go to some way in addressing the concern you've raised?
Not really. The point I was trying to make was that he hadn't evaluated the impact of what he was calculating across the CBP sector. So So I'm not sure who created those figures or what the basis of the creation was. So I can't say that that would alleviate my concern by expressing my involvement.
This is a document dated 2021, but this is the first time you've seen this, is it?
Yes, it is.
Okay, thank you. Sir, I understand Mr. Barber will be producing these. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Just copying. Is there any re-examination at that time?
You were asked about the possibility of concentration of farm plots of some localised effects and on whether that could affect achievement of targets, and in each of instance your answer was it may do. May do. Why did you qualify your answer in that way to those questions?
Really, because I have not the knowledge to say that it will be.
Thanks.
Given your best knowledge of all the options available, what sort of percentage reduction might be possible for CVP?
I would like to be accused of the same thing you're saying about tracking it on to the next witness. Mr. Barber will be able to explain to you he's running a program called the ECS, which is investigating a very exciting method, because basically my evidence I prove that nitrogen application results in nitrogen leach.
Yes. Yeah.
So he's developing a method of estimating the amount of labile nitrogen left in the ground after a crop. So if the grower can then measure the amount of labile nitrogen left in the ground, they should only be able to apply the additional nitrogen that's required to grow the crop.
Okay.
And that, theoretically, and Mr. Barber will explain more about the research that he's doing in that project around it, should reduce the amount of nitrogen being applied by growers, and so reduce the amount reaching at the bottom.
Okay. So to say you're looking it up, can you tell me what labile means in that context?
It's just the stuff that's left, sitting in the ground.
And could be reached out?
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
Thank you. Thank you.
So, Gordon, I just want to follow up on the questions you were asked by Council for Regional Council. And moving on from the business of whether it's within a sub-catchment or within the FMU, but the business of what would happen if, for example, simply within the course of a year, one farmer were to lease or swap a field with another farmer. Say, just the neighbouring farm. Now, am I right in my understanding that if you start an environment plan for the field under consideration,
That's correct. And the second farmer would have to re-evaluate the risk of the crop that they were growing and put in place mitigations to reduce that. If it's significantly different than the crop that was grown by the principals.
You anticipate, from your point of view as an economist, do you anticipate problems in relation to those transactions?
No, I don't. Because I understand they're going on now, and I don't think the EVPs will put any restraint on any activity.
The EVPs would need to be quite specific about the way in which particular areas are managed, wouldn't they, to ensure that both farmers were quite clear as to what was allowed to happen on a particular piece of land and what the consequences might be if that didn't happen.
Yes, and that's my understanding of the purpose of the risk assessment.
Thank you. Anything else?
No.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, very good. We'll adjourn now. Now, Mr. Todd, so you'll be calling Mr. Barber in the morning?
Yes, that's right.
Very good. All right. And there are some documents that we've received, well, we've received one copy now, but we've received a small bundle through the registrar that I think he's going to take us through.
Yes, I think those were roughly provided by the various generals.
Yes.
If there are others, I'll email them tonight so that we can round around and more.
Thank you.
Sorry, could I just mention something too, Mr.
Yes.
Mr. Mitchell, I noticed that we haven't got the NZ gap material. Is that what you're talking about finding tonight? Thank you very much.
And sorry, just so I can be clear, are you interested in the checklist and criteria against which that's judged, or a template, for example, of a grower or a filler template, or all of the above?
To be quite honest, I don't know
in the context of this plan change, and in the context of the evidence, including the evidence we've already heard, and any yet to come, we'd like whatever will help illustrate, I suppose, that evidence.
Thank you.
Is that helpful?
That is, yeah.
Your Honour, there's one other thing I can say. Having read the EMS paper, that must be helpful. And there is a scoring system for risk against different management elements. And I'd certainly like to understand that system as well.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much.
Any other matters of housekeeping or procedural matters that anyone wishes to raise? No, very good. 9:30 tomorrow, convening for everyone.